Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Well, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but today is July 21st, and it marks the 90th anniversary of the famed Scopes Monkey Trial in Dayton, Tennessee, a historical landmark that continues to confuse the controversy about evolution. That's the opening line of a news item that was printed by the Religion Press Release Service. Actually, it came out as part of their press release there. But it speaks about the this 90th anniversary that is taking place. And defenders of Darwinian theory, the article goes on to say, present the conflict between unguided evolution and intelligent design as if it has not advanced one bit since Clarence Darrow jousted with William Jennings Bryan over biblical literalism before the courthouse crowd in 1925. The truth, though, is very different. And to commemorate this Scopes trial, Discovery Institute Press has published a brand new book entitled Debating Darwin's Doubt, Scientific Controversy That Can No Longer Be Denied. And it's really a sequel to Dr. Stephen Meyer's best-selling book, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. And that's what we wanted to look at and talk about on the program today. Dr. Myers joins us now. Let me remind our listening audience about Dr. Meyer. He received his PhD from University of Cambridge in the philosophy of science after working as an oil industry geophysicist. He now directs the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. He's authored Signature in the Cell. It's an excellent book about looking at the cell and seeing the signature or the fingerprints of God, if I could put it that way, inside the cell. He's also appeared on many top national television networks and major talk radio programs and many Christian outlets. I've seen him speak in person a number of times. I saw him speak at a Ligonier conference. The presentation was just excellent. Always a pleasure to have him on the radio program. So, Dr. Myers, welcome back to the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Dr. Myers, we may better give people a little bit of a refresher course on the Scopes trial and what took place and, you know, what was the major issue that was going on there?
Well, this the trial took place in 1925 in the summer, and the presenting issue legally was a teacher who had taught his students about the theory of evolution, which in Tennessee at that time was something that was illegal to do. The backstory, though, is that the townspeople of Dayton were looking for something that would put their town on the map, and the ACLU was looking for a test case as a way to kind of embarrass religious fundamentalists, and it became a national show trial. The teacher was found guilty and fined all of $100, but the national media it descended on the city or on the small town, and there were people writing about it from all the major newspapers. H.L. Mencken was the most famous commentator, a journalist for the Baltimore Sun, and it became emblematic in the public imagination of the battle between science and the Bible, science and religion, in part because of a later depiction of the trial that was turned into a movie called Inherit the Wind, starring Spencer Tracy. And the movie in many ways bore no resemblance to what actually happened at the trial, and the trial in turn really was not an adequate or an accurate reflection of the nature of the scientific controversy about Darwin's theory. So there was a kind of a double distortion over time, and but that has lived on in the popular imagination. And, in fact, it's commonly cited by the media. Any time anything comes up about Darwinian evolution in the in the popular press. So there's a kind of stereotype of the debate that has been conveyed by the depiction of the Scopes trial, and that stereotype says that there is no scientific basis for questioning Darwinian theory. This is a debate between science and religion, between reason and faith, and reason won, science won, religion and faith lost, and the only people who have doubts about Darwinian theory have those doubts for solely religious reasons.
Marvin Olasky in World Magazine has written a really good article if folks want to check into the Scopes trial itself. And he's looking at it from the angle of the lead story is entitled Happy Birthday, Culture War. And he talks about the media's role in it and how they didn't actually report what was going on in the trial, but that they were so predisposed to Darwinian thought that they completely misrepresented what was taking place in the trial, and that actually the lawyer Brian, who stood up for creationism and presenting that viewpoint, he did an excellent job. Did a wonderful job of speaking about, you know, how we should think about these issues and so forth. We were just reading just before we went on the air about the Scopes trial that the teacher that you were referring to, that he actually never taught the subject in his class, that he really had skipped. He said he skipped that chapter. It was a chapter in a book that he was using, but he had skipped that chapter. So it was made to be something that it really wasn't. It was presented afterwards in a different light than what took place. But nevertheless, that marked something in American culture, and it marked this embrace of Darwinian thought, right?
Well, right, and it became emblazoned in the public imagination thanks to the way the media covered it, and thanks to its later depiction in that Inherit the Wind movie as the correct impression or the correct interpretation of the nature of the debate. And so the debate was a debate between science and religion, and there were no scientific reasons for doubting anything about Darwinian theory. And I wrote the book Darwin's Doubt in part to show that media stereotype is false. That in fact Darwin himself had doubts about his theory that he expressed way back in the Origin of Species. One particular doubt about a major event in the history of life known as the Cambrian explosion, in which all the major groups of animals arose very suddenly in the fossil record. And Darwin acknowledged that this was contrary to the way he depicted the history of life, as he depicted it as a great branching tree in which the major groups of animals would have arisen very gradually through small incremental variations and natural selection acting on those variations over long periods of time. And the evidence of the fossil record was very contrary to that depiction of the history of life. And as a result, he said that the Cambrian explosion was represented a valid objection to the views here entertained.
Hmm.
Well, that's quite contrary to the stereotype that says there are no scientific objections or grounds for skepticism about the theory. Darwin himself recognized that there were such grounds. And so there have been scientific challenges to his theory ever since. In fact, what I show in the book is that Cambrian explosion, which in Darwin's mind was something of a minor anomaly, the one clue he couldn't explain, that Cambrian explosion event has now grown up to be illustrative of a major crisis in evolutionary theory that is undermining the idea that there is a consensus about evolutionary theory. In fact, today, the modern textbook theory that we all learn in schools, neo-Darwinism, has been rejected by many leading evolutionary biologists, and there is no consensus about what should replace that theory. There are many new theories being proposed, none of which has gained anything like universal assent among the scientists who work on this issue. So it's a little bit of the scientifically the wild, wild west, and yet in the textbooks in major in statements by the major science organizations, in the media, Darwinian theory is presented as something that is beyond dispute, and that the only people who have any who have raised any questions about it are benighted or ignorant religious fundamentalists.
So the spin that began there in 1925 and the Scopes trial continues on today, not giving really the real core arguments associated with the case, but really just spinning it and talking about creating a controversy between faith and science that's really not there, and also not presenting the facts in an honest way. Let me just make sure our listening audience understand exactly where we're going today. Dr. Meyer wrote a book called Darwin's Doubt. It became, I think, number 7, one of the best-selling books on the New York Times best-selling list. And after he wrote that book, there was a lot of people then that wrote, scientists, I imagine, and so forth, that wrote against what you had said in the book. And the new book now that is debating Darwin's Doubt, Dr. Meyer and other leading scholars, then they're addressing those questions that were raised by those that disagreed with what he said in his first New York Times best-selling book. That's what this book is about, right?
Right. It's a compilation of all the responses to various critics of the book Darwin's Doubt, and I've written 10 chapters in this new book, and I have a our team of scientists here at Discovery Institute has written another 34 responses, and so in the process we tell the story of the reception of the book, and there's some humorous aspects to this, because we had scientists on the Darwinian side who were reviewing the book before the book was even published. One biologist at the evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago, Jerry Coyne, reviewed it over a month before it was out, and he depicted the book's argument as baby Jesus made the animal phyla. Well, it wasn't quite the way I argued the case, you know. So another young scientist who was at the time a PhD student at Cal Berkeley wrote a book review that he published on the 19th of June. The book was released on Amazon on the 18th. The book review was 9,400 words, and there were only about 116 words quoting anything from the book. So it raised some suspicions as to when it exactly had been written.
Yeah.
So there was, in any case, we responded to all the substantive scientific critiques of the book, and had a little fun in the process. And this new book, Debating Darwin's Out, debate is out today. If nothing else, shows that there's a vibrant debate around these issues, quite to the contrary of the impression that people gain from media reports that use the Scopes trial as the trope to depict what's going on in the in this debate.
When you know, it's rather suspicious when you see these types of instantaneous and highly personal attacks against what you wrote. I guess that speaks to that there's some sort of a coordinated effort to undermine these things, you know, to try to dismiss them out of hand without really looking at the data.
Well, I don't know if there was a coordinated effort, but there certainly was some level of desperation. We also had several different attempts to with people who attempted to impersonate me on Facebook and put words in my mouth through these phony Facebook pages that would discredit what I'm arguing. And there was also some of the major book chains classified the book in the religion section of their stores. At Amazon, there was a concerted attempt led by this professor, Jerry Coyne, and a group that he's involved with called the American Freedom From Religion Foundation to get Amazon to declassify the book as a science book and to instead classify it as a religion book a book of Christian inspiration. And the publisher of the book, Harper One, which is a very large trade publisher, fought back on that and got the book reclassified as it should be. There's 752 scientific references in the book, no references to Calvin, Luther, Augustine, or any known theologians. So I think some of these attacks on the book have had very little to do with its substance, but have revealed instead what one of my colleagues calls a metaphysical panic.
Mm-hmm.
So
I should make sure that our listening audience know why that's the case. It's not that you're ashamed of anything that is found in the Christian record. You yourself are a Christian, and it's let me remind our listening audience of your title. He directs the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, and he's talking about intelligent design. So very specifically, looking at it from a non-religious standpoint, looking at the data from a scientific standpoint, and talking about where that data points. It points to a designer. Is that a fair way to state it?
Well, sure. And the essential point here is that the evidence for intelligent design is scientific. It's based on things we observe in the natural world. For example, the little tiny miniature machines, the nanotechnology that's being discovered inside cells, living cells, the digital code stored in the DNA molecule. We know from experience that it takes a programmer to make a software program, and yet we have inside the cell something that is functioning like a software program. And so we have powerful evidence for designing intelligence, and yet this evidence is scientific. And people who oppose the theory of intelligent design and who are staunch defenders of modern neo-Darwinism, the modern form of Darwinian theory, want to say that they want to dismiss that evidence and the argument for intelligent design as being religion. And that goes back to this Scopes trial stereotype. If they can dismiss it as being religious, then they feel that they've shown that it doesn't have a factual basis.
Mm-hmm.
And our argument is different. We want to show that there is a factual basis, an evidential basis, for the conclusion of intelligent design. Once you have drawn that conclusion, it may have larger worldview implications that are friendly to theistic belief, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is that the argument for design is not based on religion. It's based on science, but the scientific evidence may, in fact, have religious implications that are friendly to religious belief.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very different thing, because what the critics want to say, they want to say, well, it's based on a religious belief or religious prejudice. It has nothing to do with the evidence.
Mm.
And if they can make that case, they think they can show that what you're saying is false.
Well, having said that then, and laid out, you know, a little bit of the background here, what is the theory of intelligent design specifically? Why is it the most credible explanation for the Cambrian explosion that you mentioned earlier? How would ID explain those parts that Darwin was saying were problematic for him?
Yeah, that's a great question. The theory of intelligent design affirms that there are certain features of the natural world, of the physical world, and of the biological systems that are best explained by the activity of a designing intelligence rather than an undirected, unguided natural process, such as, for example, natural selection. In the case of the Cambrian explosion, what we have is in the history of life is the sudden emergence, the abrupt emergence of a whole range of new animal forms or new animal body plans. And to build these animals, we now know that a great amount of new information, biological information stored in the DNA molecule and elsewhere, would have been necessary to produce these forms of life. I used to ask my students, if you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? And they would know that the answer to that question is code or information or instructions or software. And it turns out the same thing is true in life. So the Cambrian explosion doesn't just represent a huge infusion of new form, biological form, into the fossil record. It represents an infusion of new information into the history of life, the information needed to build these forms of life. But again, what we know from our experience, our uniform and repeated experience, which is the basis of all scientific reasoning, is that information always arises from an intelligent source, whether we're talking about a section of software code in a computer or a paragraph in a book or a hieroglyphic inscription. Information always issues ultimately from a mind, not a material process. So when we see a big infusion of information in the history of life, I argue that the best explanation for that event is of the activity of a designing mind, a designing intelligence acting in the history of life, not an undirected material process. And that's the basis of the argument for intelligent design, or one of the bases.
Well, in that you said that implied that computer programmers were living and intelligent individuals. There might be some people that would debate that on the on the program that have dealt with them. I'm just joking. But let me ask you about the.
Well, we have these debates out here in Microsoft country about Apple versus Microsoft, and it gets kind of personal,
exactly.
About who's writing better code, you know.
I came out of that.
But generally, it's conceded that it takes a programmer to produce a program, even if it might have a few glitches in it.
Right? Yeah, exactly. I came out of that world, and so I was working in between the people that did the programming and the people that actually used it, a liaison between those two. And so I had my battles there, and there was some question about whether there was really life in the programming side, and certainly whether there was intelligence there or not. They gave him a tough time. But anyways, let me ask you about what then were the chief criticisms of Darwin's doubt? You just it seemed to make complete sense what you just said there, and it's like, okay, well, that's easy to understand, and certainly seems not only plausible, but it seems the right response to what we see in the design during the Cambrian explosion. What were some of the other chief criticisms about what you wrote in Darwin's Doubt then?
Well, thanks for asking that. It's an important question. Initially, there were a lot of kind of frivolous criticisms that were nitpicking about minor matters concerning the paleontology or classification of this animal or that animal. And it didn't really address this core information argument. And we answered those criticisms, and one was that I had exaggerated the brevity of the Cambrian explosion, but in fact I used the standard age date for the explosion and dated the duration of the explosion as most of the Cambrian experts do. So even those kind of trivial criticisms we think were incorrect. But there was a major review that came out in the journal Science in September of 2013, several months after the book was published. And the reviewer did attempt to answer the main information argument of the book. And he said, Meyer argues that you need a lot of new information to build these new Cambrian animals. But he says, that's not our present understanding. He says, our present understanding is that all that would need to happen would be for the evolutionary process to rewire the networks of genes that control other pre-existing genes that code for these key parts of the Cambrian animals. That sounded pretty sophisticated, and like maybe I'd missed something until you broke it down. And because a network of genes contains pre-existing information, and when they act, and the already existing genes that those networks act upon also contain pre-existing genetic information, and to rewire the networks of genes would require multiple coordinated changes in code, which would require an infusion of information, and all those sources of information that were presupposed in that scenario that was sketched out in this review are unexplained on a Darwinian point of view. And so even if you say, well, maybe those sources of information existed someplace before the Cambrian explosion and some other earlier animals, you would still need to explain the origin of that information, and neither the reviewer nor anyone else in evolutionary biology has done that. So it was a kind of interesting response, because this is a very good scientist, one that I respect a lot, and I later had a debate with him on British radio. But on this point, you don't need a PhD in biology to see what's wrong about his response. He simply begged the question as to the existence of as to the existence of several sources of unexplained genetic information. So that doesn't really solve the problem that I'm pointing out. At best, it just pushes it back in time. So I think that was a very interesting and revelatory response. I was really happy to get that critique, because it exposed the weakness in the Darwinian side, or in this case, this scientist is actually skeptical himself about neo-Darwinism. He's exploring other evolutionary models, but so be it. None of these materialistic evolutionary theories have accounted for the origin of information.
Well, I think it actually helped your point as well, that it was acknowledging the idea of the information that was there, and that highlighting the point that we have all this information had to come from somewhere. He's just saying that there was more information, so he's, in some way, I think he's kind of endorsing the point that you made,
well,
even though he's drawn a different...
reinforcing it.
Reinforcing, yes.
Yeah.
Well, let me, Dr. Meyer, thank you so much for being with us today, but I want to mention that Dr. Meyer is going to be here in the upstate of South Carolina. He's scheduled to be September 18th and 19th. He's is the Truth for a New Generation conference that's going to take place First Baptist in Spartanburg. This is put on by Alex McFarlane and Tony Beam and the folks over there at North Greenville University. And Dr. Meyer is scheduled to be one of the speakers at that event. Dr. Meyer, I have to shoot an email over to your folks there at Discovery Institute to see if we can set something up here, maybe while you're in town, at least to come over to the studio, or maybe I could do another in-person interview over there at the event. But
That'd be fun.
I'd love to see if we could set up some other ancillary events around that speaking event. But thank you so much for writing this book. Thank you for your work at the Institute there. You guys are doing a great job.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Okay. That was Dr. Stephen Meyer again. And the book that we're highlighting today is the book we were talking about with answering or debating those that have answered what Dr. Meyer had to say in his book, Darwin's Doubt. That's what we were talking about on the program today. So it's Debating Darwin's Doubt. That's the title of the new book, and you can go out to their website in order to find out how you can get a copy of it. Remember, Jesus said this, "You shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free."
You're listening to Knowing the Truth. To keep this ministry strong and coming your way, you can make a financial gift at knowingthetruth.org by clicking on the Donate button. You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.